Good morning, and it's good to be here. See all of your happy, smiling faces. As we were singing "A La 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 La," I thought, you know, song I used to sing way back when. So, in grade school and middle school, high school, you know, back when I was a kid. Reminds me of those youth group and summer camp days. There's a news clipping that I found. It's from about 12 years ago. It was in the Ottawa Citizen and writing from Winnipeg. The title of this little clipping reads, "Church closes food bank because it attracts poor people." And here's the article. A busy church food bank known for offering warm drinks and snacks to its regulars has announced its closing because it is attracting too many poor people. It's attracting a lot of street people that made it uncomfortable, said Charlotte Croson, Unity Truth Center minister Thursday. It's creating social unrest in the church. A food bank is a social service, and that is not who we are. Ms. Prosen said the program is being canceled to focus on more church-specific activities. The church's board of trustees made the decision to cancel the bi-monthly food bank after receiving an email from a sister church in Victoria. And this is what the email, part of the email apparently said. Most clients of food banks have not yet come to a sense of personal responsibility in life. They are still in denial, blame, or seeing the world as owing them, wrote Reverend David Dirksen of the Unity Church of Victoria. Ms. Prosen praised the work done by food banks and said the church will still collect food for baskets, but focus more on people's spiritual hunger. Now, I don't know about you, but, you know, this is an old news. But it just doesn't strike me as right. There's something wrong about that. But think about it. Are there people, individuals, groups of people that we're uncomfortable with, that if we're called to go help them, we're reluctant to do so? Or are there groups of people, individuals, who we think, they need to stand up and do stuff for themselves? No, I don't want to go help them until they learn to help themselves. Or what about people that you don't like, people who may have even hurt you verbally, emotionally, perhaps even physically? Have you ever felt like you wanted to take revenge out on someone? Have you ever wanted to, have you ever demanded of God to strike down and judge someone? Maybe not literally, but maybe you've had those feelings. I sure have. There are some people who have hurt me deeply. I don't like them. If I had my way, they wouldn't be living anymore. There are people that, and groups of people that, I just would rather not deal with, to be perfectly honest. And that's going to get us to the story of Jonah. Just a little bit of background into the history around that time of Jonah. The kingdom of Israel had long been split into the northern and southern kingdoms. Jonah is a prophet of the northern kingdom, the kingdom of Israel. It is during the reign of the second king named Jeroboam. And during this time, Israel, this kingdom, is experiencing a period of prosperity, which in fact, Jonah had said would happen. And this is found in 2 Kings chapter 14, verse 25. I'm not going to read it, just to let you know that it's there. Jonah is mentioned in 2 Kings. There were at least two contemporary prophets to Jonah at that time. They were Hosea and Amos. Both had prophesied judgment that would be coming against Israel because of her sins. And of the two, Hosea specifically had named Assyria as one that would be used to bring about this judgment. At this particular time, during the reign of Jeroboam II, Assyria itself is in a weakened state. Assyria had been oppressing the nations around prior to this, but they had entered a period of a little bit of decline, and so it's in a weakened state. Therefore, many of the nations around had been able to come from under its grips, and Israel is now experiencing prosperity. And so it is in this setting that Jonah is called. And Jonah chapter 1, verse 1. Now this Jonah's story is one of those where to get the message of Jonah, you have to go through the whole story. We're not going to read the whole story, but I don't have a choice. I have to go through the whole story. And so I'll read portions and I'll narrate some of the others. So beginning in chapter 1, verse 1. Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, "Arise, go to Nineveh, the great city." Nineveh is the city of Assyria, the capital city, basically. "And call out against it." And to call out against it would mean to speak a message of judgment against it. "For their evil has come up before me." So fairly straightforward. But, little word, but. "But Jonah rose." Oh, so he's going to, the call was from God was to arise and go to Nineveh. So looks like Jonah is going to go. But no. "But Jonah rose to flee to Tarshish." Tarshish is considered, we don't exactly know where it is. It's thought to be somewhere in the western Mediterranean, perhaps in Spain. So completely opposite direction. Nineveh is inland from Israel. Tarshish is across the sea, across the Mediterranean, towards Spain. "But Jonah rose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa and found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare and went down into it to go with them to Tarshish, away from the presence of the Lord." Now first thing to note is we are not yet given why Jonah chose to flee to Tarshish. We don't know yet why. No reason is given. But he does. He chooses to disobey God's command. And in these opening few verses, there's a repetition of the word "down" as opposed to "arise." God's command was to arise and go. And Jonah started to rise and go, but instead he went down. And the writer of this little book repeats the word "down" to show that he is going in the opposite direction. It is a metaphor for, down is a metaphor for reaching the depths. Perhaps a place of the dead, in fact. And so instead of going to where God wants, Jonah is going to the opposite end of things. It's interesting that Jonah is even trying to flee from the presence of the Lord. Now, doesn't Jonah know better? Well, maybe, maybe not. Because one of the things is that at that time, most of the people, especially the non-Israelites, would have believed that gods were territorial, that you could, in fact, flee from the area, from the sphere of influence of individual deities. And perhaps Jonah had been influenced by that, or perhaps Jonah thought maybe that was sort of true of Israel's God as well. But he tries to escape God. What happens then is that Jonah books passage on this boat, off to Tarshish, and some commentaries note that this would have been perhaps a 1.5 year journey to Tarshish. It was a long time. Because the people feared the open sea. And the boats were not designed for the open sea, so they would hug the coastline. So it would take a very long time going through the coastline of the Mediterranean all the way to western Mediterranean, perhaps Spain. Their cargo would consist of things like lumber, olive oil, things that would keep for such a long journey. A severe storm comes that threatens to take down the ship. The sailors fear for their lives, and they do everything they can to lighten the load so that the boat would not sink. Finally, they've thrown everything they possibly could overboard, and they're still desperate. And they find that Jonah is sleeping in the boat. And perhaps this is indicative of his apathy and his lack of compassion. He doesn't really care. He doesn't care what happens. Doesn't seem to care what happens to him, to the boat, or to any of the sailors. He's just sleeping, perhaps a symbol of that. But Jonah is awakened, and lots are cast, and he's the first to have to declare why he thinks this storm is about to destroy them. And in response, Jonah says, this is verse 9 of chapter 1, "I am a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land." What Jonah says is true. It's orthodox. It's theologically correct. He has correct knowledge. But his practice contradicts his words. His words were, "I fear the Lord." Did he really? His actions indicate otherwise. But this description of God increases the terror for the sailors, because this is not just what Jonah described is not just some local deity who is in charge of, say, the harvest or birth or the well-being of a family or a tribe, but what Jonah described is a cosmic God, the Creator. And these sailors realize that this God could indeed be responsible for this storm that's happening around them. And it disturbs them. It's interesting that Jonah, again, in his words, he declares his God to be a cosmic God in charge of everything, yet he wants to run away from the presence of such a God. Again, it seems to indicate a lack of true understanding of his God. The sailors then ask Jonah what they should do. What they should do in order to calm the storm. And Jonah says to them, this is verse 12, "Pick me up and hurl me into the sea. then the sea will quiet down for you, for I know it is because of me that this great tempest has come upon you. That's Jonah's solution. One might think Jonah would come to his senses and say, you know, maybe I should turn around and go back and do what God had originally asked me to do. But apparently that's nowhere in his thoughts. His thought is just throw me into the sea. I don't care what happens to me. No, just throw me into the sea. Complete lack of feeling, it almost seems like. In great contrast, the sailors, this is verse 13, nevertheless, the men rowed hard to get back to dry land, but they could not, for the sea grew more and more tempestuous against them. In spite of what Jonah had told them, the sailors, well, they don't want to be responsible for Jonah's death. Well, these pagan sailors have far greater compassion and mercy on Jonah. Jonah didn't deserve it, any. But the sailors show mercy and compassion, whereas Jonah shows nothing of the sort. But the storm increases in fury, and they realize, well, they can't do anything except to do what Jonah had asked them to do. So they picked up Jonah and hurled him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows. So the sailors finally do what they have to do. The sea apparently calms down in a miraculous instant. And because of that, the sailors realize that, you know, this God, the God of Israel, has far greater power than any that they have experienced. And so their immediate response is to worship, to sacrifice and to offer vows. We need to keep that little phrase tucked in the back of our minds, offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows, because it's going to come again in the next chapter. So what happens to Jonah? Well, this is where what everyone knows, the part of the story everyone knows, is this big fish comes, swallows Jonah, and Jonah is saved, whether he wanted to be saved or not. And chapter 2 of Jonah records Jonah's prayer from the belly of the whale. The prayer is very orthodox. It contains all the right words. It's what any good Israelite would have prayed to his or her God. But towards the end, in verses 7 to 9, I find something a little disturbing. Verses 7 and 9 read, "When my life was fainting away, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer came to you into your holy temple." Okay, that's fine. And in verse 8, however, it continues, "Those who pay regard to vain idols forsake their hope of steadfast love. But I, with the voice of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you what I have vowed I will pay. Salvation belongs to the Lord." I see in there once more a kind of a lack of understanding that Jonah has, or a prejudice that Jonah has in regards to who can receive God's mercy. Jonah doesn't really believe or want those who are outside of the little circle of Israel to receive God's mercy. You know, those who pay regard to vain idols forsake their hope and steadfast love. That's what Jonah is saying. But already we saw in chapter 1 that these pagan sailors who have been crying out to all sorts of different gods, when they realize that no one except Jonas, the God Jonas serves, is able to save them, they turn to him. And the God of Israel saves these pagan sailors. Jonah believes that because of his orthodoxy, his sacrifices, and his vows, that he can be saved. That's verse 9. But I, with the voice of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you what I have vowed I will pay. Salvation belongs to the Lord. As we saw already in chapter 1, this sacrifice and vow come after the salvation. It's a response to salvation. It's not the means to salvation. And Jonah seems to get that kind of backwards. At least that's what I get when I read Jonah's prayer as recorded in Jonah chapter 2. Continuing with the story, the fish vomits Jonah out. How pleasant that must have been. And afterwards, Jonah is called again to arise and go to Nineveh. Jonah proclaims the message of coming judgment against the city and against the nation of Assyria. And what is the response? What is the response of the people of Nineveh? What is the response of the king? This is chapter 3, verses 6 through 9. The word reached the king of Nineveh, and he arose from his throne, removed his robe, and covered himself with sackcloth, and sat in ashes. And he issued a proclamation and published through Nineveh, by the decree of the king and his nobles, let neither man nor beast, herd nor flock taste anything. Let them not feed or drink water, but let man and beast be covered with sackcloth, and let them call out mightily to God. Let everyone turn from his evil way and from the violence that is in his hands. Who knows? God may turn and relent and turn from his fierce anger so that we may not perish. The judgment message that Jonah proclaimed was basically, in 40 days, Nineveh will be destroyed. Jonah gave no basis for hope. Yet, the people of Nineveh, from the king all the way down, they express a hope that maybe God will have some sort of mercy for them. Their primary offense, apparently, according to their confession, is violence, which is the opposite of compassion and of mercy. Now, the Assyrians were known for their violence, for their cruelty. When they went out and conquered neighboring territories, they did not treat the conquered well at all, even in those barbaric times. They were known particularly for their violence and cruelty. And that's one of their confessions and their repentance is, we're going to confess that we have been cruel, we have been violent, and we're going to turn from that. What is God's response? Well, if according to Jonah's prayer, God really shouldn't have shown them any sort of mercy or compassion. According to Jonah's message of judgment, it shouldn't have mattered whether the Ninevites repented or not. But, chapter 3, verse 10 of Jonah, when God saw what they did, how they turned from their evil way, God relented of the disaster that he had said he would do to them, and he did not do it. So God shows mercy. God shows compassion. Even to Israel's arch enemies. The response of Jonah, however, is displeasure. Continues in chapter 4, but it displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he was angry. And he prayed to the Lord and said, "O Lord, is not this what I said when I was yet in my country?" I imagine Jonah kind of, you know, throwing a temper tantrum like a two-year-old on the ground, beating it, you know, kicking, sort of. "That is why I made haste to flee to Tarshish." Now we know why Jonah disobeyed in the first place. He didn't like his God. He thought his God was just far too merciful and compassionate. "This is why I made haste to flee to Tarshish, for I knew that you are a gracious God and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and relenting from disaster. Therefore now, O Lord, just please take my life from me, for it is better for me to die than to live." Well, complete temper tantrum. Doesn't like his God. He doesn't like the way God's acting. Says, "I don't like you. Just kill me. Just take my life away. I want nothing to do with you." Assyria is in a weakened state, as I mentioned right towards the beginning when I was giving you a little bit of the background here. Assyria was it was a perfect time for Assyria to be destroyed. The oppressor of God's people, Israelites in the past, and the instrument of prophesied judgment in the future. If Assyria ceased to exist, the prophecies of judgment on Israel certainly could not come to pass. That perhaps was part of Jonah's thinking. But because if Assyria is allowed to survive, if they repent at this time, and if God doesn't destroy them, then they're going to exist as a people, and then what? Well, though it might get stronger, and they might come to destroy Israel. In fact, that's exactly what happened 30 to 60 years after Jonah. Assyria comes, conquers Israel. The northern kingdom of Israel is scattered all over. You know, perhaps given, you know, if we think of 30 years, perhaps Jonah was there to even witness that happen. So from a logical safety, security point of view, Jonah's concern with God and with Assyria is sound. No, God just destroyed Assyria, so this problem will go away. But God doesn't do that. Jonah, as the story continues to sit, and he waits to see what happens. Now, maybe God relents for time, but maybe he'll destroy Nineveh. Jonah builds a booth. God sends a vine to create a shade. A worm kills this plant. The sun beats down on Jonah, dries the plant, and Jonah is miserable. He's hot, he's miserable, he's depressed, he's suicidal. In a very bad place. The only thing he's sorry for is the plant. God, why did you have to kill the plant? Why did you have to kill the plant? I liked that plant. It sheltered me. Why did it die? Finally, God comes and has a little conversation with Jonah about his attitude problem. Starting in verse 9 of chapter 4, "But God said to Jonah, 'Do you do well to be angry for the plant?' And he, Jonah, said, 'Yes, I do. I do well to be angry enough to die.' And the Lord said, You pity the plant for which you did not labor, nor did you make it grow, which came into being in the night and perished in the night. And should not I pity Nineveh, that great city in which there are more than 120,000 persons who do not know their right hand from their left, and also much cattle? The book of Jonah ends in a question. Ends in a question because the intent of the writer of this story is to make sure that the readers ask that for themselves. What's most important? What is the most important thing about God? And as we ponder that question, just want to take a few moments here to turn to the New Testament to see what the New Testament, just a few selections, has to say about God and about mercy. First is from Luke chapter 6, part of which we read this morning. I'm going to start in Luke chapter 6, verse 32. I'm going to read 32, 33, and then 35, 36. If you love those who love you, what benefit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what benefit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. But love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return. And your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for He is kind to the ungrateful and the evil. Be merciful, even as your Father is merciful. And in Matthew chapter 12, verse 7, Jesus says, "And if you had known what this means, 'I desire mercy and not sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the guiltless." James, in chapter 2, verses 8, 9, and skipping down to 13, writes, "If you really fulfill the royal law according to the scriptures, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you are doing well. But if you show partiality, you are committing sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. For judgment is without mercy to one who has shown no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment." And these are just a few selections. The topic of mercy and compassion is all over the place in the New Testament. But this goes along completely with what the Hebrews, the Jews, would have understood about God. Because when Moses asked God to reveal himself at Sinai, the self-characterization of God was this. This is Exodus chapter 34, verse 6. "The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, 'The Lord, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness.'" From this, the message I get is that mercy seems to be one of the primary distinguishing characteristics of God, and consequently also His true children, His family, the family of God, His children, also should exhibit the same kind of mercy that God is all about. And so, what does that mean? Perhaps that means that the true test of whether we value mercy or not is how we respond to those that have hurt us, or those we dislike, and perhaps even those we hate. Now, if we belong to God, how do we relate to those that, from a human point of view, we don't like? We disagree with, emotionally, we get uptight about. We may even hate. They may have even hurt us in the past. How do we relate to them? Is it possible to relate to people like that with mercy as God wants us to? And the answer there is a qualified yes. No, we cannot in our own human strength. But we can if we allow the power of Jesus Christ to work through us, to change us. The Apostle Paul wrote in Colossians chapter 3, verses 1, 2, and then skipping down to 12, 13, and 14. If then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things that are above, where not on things that are on earth. Put on then, as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience, bearing with one another, and if one has a complaint against another, forgiving each other. As the Lord has forgiven you, so you also must forgive. And above all these, put on love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. The key there is, seek the things that are above. Seek Christ. When you look upon Christ, when you look upon Jesus, the change will come. And we will be able to be merciful, not just to people we like, our friends, but to all. So look at Christ. Let the stories of Jesus, how Jesus dealt with people, change the way we live. Let him change our hearts.